This evening, my talk is very timely. It's on impermanence. But before we get started, I want to read you a poem. I'm a poem person, so I'm going to read poems throughout the whole evening, at least the next 40 minutes or so. This poem is called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still, and just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe, and be, and walk slowly into the mystery. And that's Dana Fouts. And it so reminds me of just getting here today. My friend and I, Devin, we came from Oakland. And I was just talking in the kitchen. I said, you know, oh boy, the traffic was something. And a fellow Sangha member said, you should have left at 2. And I said, well, I left at 3. And I think it's the hurrying and the busyness that we are all facing right now. I know one of the things that I have come to recently is when people have asked me, so Noli, how are you? You know, the first response is always, but I am so busy. And what I realized in that was that I was actually separating myself. There was something about that. I don't know if you could even feel, I'm so busy. And then you go, okay. I won't, or can I get on your calendar? That kind of thing, right? So then I decided to change the word, take it out of my lexicon in my mind. And I'd said, okay, when somebody asks me, I'm going to say, they say, so how are you, Noli? And I say, I am so full. And at some point it worked, but then it didn't. Because then it started to be the same thing. And so what I've added to my new vocabulary lexicon is when somebody says, so how are you, Noli? I just say, I am so abundant. Because I've actually called all this in. You know? And shame on me if I called in too much and I can't handle it. You know, the old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So there is this sense that the hurrying, this, what Dana Fouts had said, walking slowly into what the mystery is. And the truth of the matter is the mystery is always going to be changing. Life is uncertain. Not news. There's a lot of things that just show up and we thought, how did that happen? So I'm going to ask a question here. Is it possible to find ease and grace in a world full of change? Is it possible to trust the mind of non-clinging and so find our liberation within the world of impermanence? That's Gil Fronsdahl. Is it possible to find ease and grace in a world full of change? So let's just examine for a moment this mental construct of how we like to stay put. Change is very uncomfortable for many people. You know, it's as if we want to create permanence. We want to create this fixed thinking. We're not going to move off of it, right? I'm right. And what it really does is it restricts a fluidity of mind and heart. So we've all heard those love songs, haven't we? Stay with me. Don't leave me. Just stay. And I don't know if any of you remember the Dells. It was a singing group. Won't you stay? Stay in my corner. You know, just stay here. Always stay here. Is it possible? Is it possible to trust that there is actually liberation in impermanence? And it's in that sense of wanting to hold on and wanting to stay where we lose the actual essence of our lives. This sense that impermanence, this change is always happening. That's the one constant, is change. I remember a partner asked me once, early on in our relationship, will you love me forever? I took a moment. And then I took a breath. And then I said no. And believe me, it took them aback. It's like, what? Because, you know, that's what we are conditioned, you know, forever. But what I did clarify was that I don't know what forever is. But what I will do is I'll love you now. And tomorrow, I'll love you now. And the next day, I will love you now. So this sense of change, I mean, think about the caterpillar and the butterfly. You know, you've got this caterpillar and then it builds its chrysalis and then it breaks open and it's free. Change, impermanence. The Buddha said all conditioned things have the nature of vanishing. In the Majjhima Nikaya, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates impermanence in this manner. He says, anicca, impermanence, is the bedrock of the Buddha's teaching. A gentleman named Adam Frank wrote, we feel it with each breath. From birth to the unknown moment of our passing, we ride a river of change. And yet, in spite of all evidence to the contrary, we exhaust ourselves in an endless search for solidity. We hunger for something that lasts, some idea or principle that rises above time and change. We hunger for certainty, and indeed, that's a big problem. You know, just like in the meditation when I said, you know, this is such a gift we have, these 45 minutes. To still our minds, to sit in meditation, in loving awareness. And it's a timeless moment. It could have been 42 minutes. It could have been 39. It was actually 43. The deep knowing and living with impermanence is an entryway and a gateway to liberation. What we only really know for sure is that change is constant. And there's wisdom to be found in that if we just actually understand that we can embrace that and not push through this place of holding on and clinging. You know, the Buddha's teachings are so multi-layered. And as he began to find his way to the Bodhi tree, long journey to do that, he began to sit and find this place of awakening. There were so many things that he went back to he went back to his past in order to discover what was happening as he was becoming enlightened. So I want to talk a little bit about a story. I'm sure you all probably know this story of the Buddha in the palace. Right? When Siddhartha Gautama was born, a sage came to his father, and his father said, tell me, what will happen to my son? And the spiritual guide, the soothsayer, said, two things can happen to Prince Gautama. If he's protected from the ills of the world, he will become a powerful and wise ruler. If he renunciates, he will become a great spiritual teacher. And immediately his father said, I want him to be the ruler. I don't want him to have that other befall upon him, and that would be seeing the ills and the suffering of the world. So as a result, his father held him in his castle, but built it beautifully for him. He had everything he needed. All the princely life. He had gold, he had refinement, he had luxury, everything you could imagine. He actually had three palaces. One for the cold season, one for the hot season, and one for the rainy season. I mean, I only have one house. In a discourse, the Buddha said to his monks that he never left his palace during the rainy season because he was taken care of by all his servants and pampered by all the women. However, he got curious, which I love this piece of the story. So he went to his friend, his attendant, Chana. He was his chariot rider. And he said, let's leave the palace gates. And when he asked his father said, you can do this, but first let me do one thing. And so he had everything around the palace cleared away, so he wouldn't see anything, right? So one day, he and Chana rode out on their horses beyond the palace gates. And the first thing that Siddhartha and Chana saw on their journey was an elder man with sores, and he was walking with difficulty. Siddhartha asked Chana, what was the nature of this man? Chana replied, he was a sick man. He continued to say, everyone will get sick. You'll get sick. Your parents will get sick. I'll get sick. All people are going to get sick. At that point, Siddhartha was just in overwhelm. He said, let's go back to the palace. So I'm sure at that point, Chana went, phew, good. Okay, we're going to have to go back out. Well, guess what, the next day. Siddhartha Gautama said, Chana, let's go out beyond the palace gates again. Okay. So at this point, they started on their journey, and they happened upon another person walking very slowly with a cane, thin and wispy hair. Siddhartha said to Chana, what is the nature of this man? He said, he's old. Everybody will get old. You'll get old, I'll get old, your parents will get old. And after that reflection and discovery, Siddhartha said, I've had enough. Let's go back to the palace. Again, hope we don't have to do that again. Next day, Siddhartha says, let's go back out beyond the gates. This time, as they left and they approached the village, he saw people walking in a procession with a large plank ahead of them, and it was a body on it. Siddhartha asked Chana, what's going on here? What is this? Chana replied, it was a funeral. Somebody had died. He said, Prince, everybody dies. You will die, I will die, your parents will die. Everybody is going to die. Siddhartha was quite disturbed. He said, I need to go back. He had a restless night that night. So again, the next day, he said, Chana, let's go out beyond the palace gates. So again, Chana obeyed, and out they rode. And what did they find? They found a man draped in orange cloth, and he seemed to have, with every single step, a sense of peace, a sense of grace. Again, Siddhartha asked his friend and attendant, who is that Chana? Chana replied, that was a man who was a renunciant, a yogi. He has let go of all of his worldly possessions in order to find the truth. So what Siddhartha witnessed on all of these occasions when he left the palace gates, what he witnessed were the four heavenly messengers. He witnessed illness, old age, death, and renunciation. It was shortly after that time that Siddhartha left the palace. And as the story goes, he also left his wife and newborn child. And this is from a sutta, the Sukkamala Sutta. And it talks a little bit about how Prince Siddhartha lived. A little bit different than I do. Monks, I lived in refinement, utmost refinement, total refinement. My father even had lotus pads made in our palace. One where red lotuses bloomed, one where white lotuses bloom, one where blue lotuses bloomed, all for my sake. I used no sandalwood that was not made, had not come from Banarsi. My turban was from there, on my tunics, my clothes, everything. I had three palaces, one for the cold season, one for the hot season, and the rainy season. During the 4 months of the rainy season, I was entertained in my palace by minstrels without a single man among them. And I did not come down from that palace. Even though I was endowed with such fortune, such total refinement, the thought occurred to me, when an untaught, run-of-the-mill person himself, subject to aging, not beyond aging, seeing another who is aged, who is horrified, humiliated, and disgusted, oblivious to himself that he is too, is subject to aging and not aging. And this goes on with illness and death. This was the beginning of Siddhartha's awakening. And he was so moved that he decided that he was going to actually become that renunciant, to give up everything. And as you know, more of the story, he left the palace. He just left everything behind, all of his riches, all of his refinement. And he began his search for the truth. And in that, he actually happened upon these three very, very important tenets to the philosophy of Buddhism. One is suffering, dukkha, anicca, impermanence, anatta, non-self. This is what arose in him after years of walking the path. Years of meditation, finding the Bodhi tree and finally sitting underneath it and deciding I was not going to get up until I found out this truth. And even then, he had all of these, what they say, Mara, all the worldly winds came at him. All of the winds blew him. All of the forces of Mara came. And quite frankly, what he did is he stayed on his seat. He stayed there while all of this was happening so that he could actually find the truth. But through wise view, paying acute attention, and understanding the three evils, greed, hatred, and delusion, the Buddha was able to move further into his own renunciation and begin to let go. And in that, understand that there was nothing to cling to, nothing to hold on to, nothing to hold fast to. And clearly, as he began to do this and began to talk to other monks and then began to teach, he realized that impermanence is the true Buddha nature. Again, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, impermanence having been the initial insight that impelled the Bodhisattva to leave the palace in search of a path of enlightenment, impermanence in the Buddhist view comprises the totality of conditioned existence, ranging in a scale from the cosmic to the microcosmic. This characteristic of impermanence that marks everything conditioned leads directly to the recognition of the universality of dukkha and suffering. So why do we hold on? Why do we cling? What makes it so appealing? What's so intoxicating about it? Or is it really the other end of it? And that's letting go. When we practice meditation or mindfulness, I've started to change the language, even another piece of my lexicon, from mindfulness, because mindfulness is such now a word that is used in everywhere. Right? Be mindful about the step, the curb, make yourself mindful. I heard Jack Kornfield use this word, and he used loving awareness. So as we bring our attention, and as we begin to cultivate this loving awareness, this moment-to-moment senses, recognition, we start to see what becomes unpleasant for us, uneasy. We start to turn away. We can turn away from it, but do we actually let it go, or does it come back to us? And then, of course, those things that we love. We can sit in meditation and go, oh, that was nice. It's funny how we judge things, right? the habit mind. I remember once I was in IMS back east in Massachusetts, and I was having it had taken me a while to settle into my meditation. And then I settled in one morning. I sat there, and when the bell rang 45 minutes later, I could have sat for another hour. And I got up and I went, that was a good sit. That was good. Oh, God. I felt like I was in bliss. That was good. So I went out for my walking meditation, and even that was good, right? I already had a judgment on it. That was good. So the next 45 minutes happened for the next meditation. So I went to my seat, and I said, I want that again. Right? How many of us want that? I want another piece of that bliss. So I sat down. I said, so how was it? I think I sat like this. No, I had a cushion. I was going to recreate that same moment. I think my tongue was like this. Okay, here it is. There it is. And 40 minutes later, I'm still trying to figure out how to recreate that moment. And then the bell rang. And that didn't stop, right? I did my walking meditation. It wasn't as good. And then I went back into the hall. I said, okay, let me do this again. No, I think it was this way. That's why it didn't happen last time. I was sitting the wrong way. And my tongue is like this. And again, 30 minutes later, I'm still trying to recreate what can't be recreated. Because of each moment is going to be different. Each breath is going to be different. And each time I was clinging to the memory and the judgment of how good it was fleeting. I'm going to read I sign up for a lot of things online. And so about once a week, I get an email from Pema Chodron. And I know she's really probably only emailing me. So this is entitled, What is Freedom? But it's not impermanence per se, or even knowing we're going to die, that is the cause of our suffering, the Buddha taught. Rather, it's our resistance to the fundamental uncertainty of our situation. Our discomfort arises from all of our efforts to put ground under our feet, to realize our dreams of constant okayness. When we resist change, it's called suffering. But when we completely let go and not struggle against it, when we can embrace the groundlessness of our situation and relax into a bit of dynamic quality, that's called enlightenment or awakening to our true nature, to our fundamental goodness. Another word for this is freedom. Freedom from struggling against the fundamental ambiguity of being human. What is so wrong with this here? Or this here? That we just can't really let go. Thought, patterns, habituations. And recognize that as we breathe in, we breathe out. That's the constant change that's happening, not only in our bodies, but it's happening in our spaces, in our energies, in our universe, in our environments. Also, I think that once we start really delving into, because I've done a little bit of looking at this state of impermanence, it's a painful journey right down that rabbit hole, because I have found myself like that picture of the cat hanging in there. I am clenched so tightly to the things that are comfortable to me. One of the last sermons that the Buddha gave, he expressed this. Impermanence is inescapable. Everything vanishes. Therefore, there is nothing more important than continuing the path with diligence. All other options either deny or short shift the problem. So all of these mental configurations that we go through around staying and holding on and not letting go and clinging only really causes that type of suffering that we just can't quite identify. Why is my life like this? Why me? I know I've said it. I'm sure you have too, right? Again? In Pali, the word for clinging, grasping, craving, is called tanha. And it's loosely translated as the unquenchable thirst. I want it. And I want more. I remember several years ago, my son borrowed our truck to go to Best Buy on the Friday after Thanksgiving to, right, to get a TV. So he got the TV, and he and his girlfriend were living in this apartment in Oakland, and he invited us over to watch a football game. This TV was so big, and their apartment was not very big. Right? I literally felt as though the football game was going on, the passer threw the ball, and I felt like I was going to catch it. It was that big. And I have to tell you, this is this place of the unquenchable thirst. Several months later, he said, "You know what, Mom, I was thinking, maybe I should buy a 52-inch TV or whatever the next size up or bigger or whatever." Are we ever satisfied? Do we actually find ourselves quenched, our thirst? Do we get full? Not always. I have another poem I want to read that really, it's a beautiful time right now. Sometimes I read it and it's not the right season, but this is called Praying for Release. Autumn. Urge me to drop every leaf I don't need, every task or habit I repeat past its season, every sorrow I rehearse, every unfulfilled hope I recall, every person or possession to which I cling, until my branches are bare, until I hold fast to nothing. Blow me about in your wild iron sky, crush all that's puffed up, fluff all that in me needs to go to seed. Send my shadows to sleep. Tutor me through straining night winds and the passion of moan and pant, the gift of letting go at the moment of most abundance, in the way of falling apples, figs, maple leaves, pecans. Open my eyes to your languid light. Let me stare in your face until I see no difference between soar and fall, until I recognize eternity in single breaths, faint whispers of cool air through lungs. Show me the way of dying in glorious boldness, yellow, gold, orange, rust, red, burgundy, brown. This is by Monza Naff. Until I see no difference between soar and fall, until I recognize eternity in single breaths, faint whispers through cool air through lungs. And permanence. Three characteristics of the one of the three characteristics of the Buddhist principles. Although we stay, we have so much of our conditioned life that we live, we can, in fact, change that course. We don't have to stay, as sweet as you are, in my corner forever. It is tantamount to suffering if we don't let go. I'm not saying that you let go of love, not at all. Or you let go of family, of course not. Or you let go of your job, any of those things. But actually, it's the mental state of understanding, of knowing, of acknowledging, of recognizing that this life is impermanent. This breath is going to change. Hoping that the administration changes as well. Amen. So I'm going to pose a couple what if questions here that actually have a little bit of, they're personal to me. So when I look in the mirror, when I looked in the mirror this morning, what I saw was I wasn't the same shape. I didn't have the same hair color. I didn't have the same taut skin as I did when I was 20. I've come to grips with it, but it hasn't always been easy. And there was a time in which it caught me holding on to the past. Should I color my hair? Well, not really, because I cut it really short and it's only going to grow back gray. Okay, I won't do that. Should I put on that really tight thing and keep me? No, this is what has happened. So what if I truly accepted the fact of aging? Without any preconditions, without anything other than embracing my body and understanding that this change can be renamed to wisdom. What if? What if I stopped believing that I was going to be the same? My thoughts were going to be the same. My trajectory in life was going to be the same. What if? Could I actually touch into the place of suffering, of how I hold on? My father died last year. He was 90 years old, and his health was failing. He had a sharp mind. He would email me and said, "Have you watched Rachel Maddow today?" Like, yeah, I did. His mind was sharp, but his body didn't carry with him. And over the last months of his life, my sister and I needed to relocate him. And believe me, he did not want to go. It was kicking and screaming time. And I realized how frustrated I was getting. I mean, I was almost like, "Dad, you know, we got to move you." You know, I was going through all of that. And his resistance to change was actually fueled by the fact that he had been living in the place that he'd been in for so long, and change was going to be difficult. So what if my father, my sister, and myself operated from absolutely knowing that he was holding on to his dignity. He was holding on to what he knew. And that the inevitability was that we were going to move him, but to limit the frustration that I was feeling, the frustration that I then put on him, the angst and all of that. What if? What if I realized that his resistance didn't have to be mine? What if? So in both of those cases, there's this way in which we can manifest, at least for myself, the truth. Everything is going to be changing, and that impermanence is something that we don't turn away from, but that we can actually be in the state of indwelling, because it's here. It's the changing of our heartbeats and how we blink our eyes. And in the course of letting go, there's a place in which we can embrace even the change. And we can actually pay attention to the things that we cling to. We can pay attention to these places in which our lives are unsettled. Greed, hatred, and delusion. So I asked the question again. Is it possible to find ease and grace in a world full of change? Is it possible to trust the mind of non-clinging and so find our liberation within the world of impermanence? Again, Gill asks these questions for us to contemplate. Turning the mirror this way, it's sometimes really not a good sight, but it's necessary. It's the learning process. It's how we go from resistance to indwelling. Ajahn Chah, Thai forest monk, says, if you let go a little, you'll find a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll find more peace. If you let go completely, you can find complete peace. It's just in the letting go. It's taking whatever you're clinging to, whether it's within your heart or your mind or your hand, and just peeling away just little by little by little by little. And actually bringing your loving awareness to what does it feel like to find freedom. I've got one more poem before we close. Oh, I have two things. Maybe three. This is something that is really about paying attention. It's from Jack Kornfield. In spiritual life, there is no room for compromise. Awakening is not negotiable. You cannot bargain to hold on to the things that pleases you while relinquishing things that do not matter to us. A lukewarm yearning for awakening is not enough to sustain us through the difficulties involved in letting go. It's important to understand that anything that can be lost was never truly ours. Anything that we deeply cling to only imprisons us. It's a choice. It's a choice point for us. Two more things. No, one more thing. Okay, one more thing. So with this choice we have of letting go, I really invite you to practice what it feels like to have freedom in your life. A little, a lot, some, always, maybe, a little here, a little there. What does it feel like? Bring your awareness to it. Ah. Even in your breath, is your breath is that the letting go that needs to happen? Is that the relinquishing? So let's take a moment and sit. Just bring ourselves back. May you awaken to the mystery of being here and enter the quiet immensity of your own presence. May you have joy and peace in the temple of your senses. May you receive great encouragement when new frontiers beckon. May you respond to the call of your gift and find the courage to follow its path. May the flame of anger free you from falsity. May warmth of heart keep your presence aflame, and may anxiety never linger about you. May your outer dignity mirror an inner dignity of soul. May you take time to celebrate the quiet miracles that seek no attention. May you be consoled in the secret symmetry of your soul. And may you experience each day as a sacred gift woven around the heart of wonder. May our practice here this evening bring about goodness in our hearts, in our minds, in this sacred sanctuary, and beyond. May we dedicate the practice to all beings, two-legged, four-legged, winged, and gilled. May all beings find freedom and peace in this world. Thank you for your kind attention and for your beautiful practice.